Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now, can democracy be taken for granted? Our guest wrote a provocative essay in late July examining whether democracies diminish because we grow disinterested, even apathetic, about nourishing them. Brown University political scientist Melvin Rogers draws on philosophers like John Dewey to ask, is democracy in the United States really so robust? As Professor Rogers and Reed Galen join us, I'd like your thoughts about this to inform the conversation today. What do you think are the hallmarks of a strong democracy? Is it economic fairness? Is it the attainment of a vision like the American dream? Is it just the idea that people utilize their right to vote? How would you define what democracy is, and how would you assess the state of our democracy? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Melvin Rogers is with us. He's an associate professor of political science at Brown University and with us today from Warwick, Rhode Island. And Melvin, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show. I'm so glad you were available to talk about this.
Well, thank you for having me.
Reed Galen is with us. He's chief strategist of the Serve America movement. He's in Park City, Utah. And Reed, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Carrie.
Melvin, this sounds like the chorus from that Joni Mitchell song, You Don't Know What You've Got Till It's Gone. I mean, is that the warning that's coming through in the essay?
Yeah, I mean, I think, that's most certainly the case. My fear is that one morning we'll wake up. I hope the morning has not already arrived, but I think one morning we might wake up and realize that the democracy that we worked so hard to build is gone.
And why do you believe that? That sounds rather apocalyptic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are moments for apocalyptic language, if only to stir folks to action. And we are seeing today not just simply an erosion of our political and legal institutions by the current administration, but I think more importantly, we're seeing the rise in a kind of basic mean-spiritedness, right? There's a way in which the Trump administration has made cruelty a virtue rather than a vice.
And so you say that the hallmarks of what we think of as democracy are being distorted in a way, what, that many of us don't recognize the implications of, the seriousness of this? I mean, what comes through in this piece that you've written is we tend to just think, no matter the kinds of slings and arrows that the democracy has to take, we'll prevail in the end. Nothing to really worry about here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a kind of, there's a basic mythos around American democracy, that the integrity of our institutions, because they were, the mythos goes, perfectly constructed, will always win the day. There's sort of two mistakes here. The first is that our institutions actually have never been perfect. But more importantly, what allows for their improvement actually has nothing to do with the institutions themselves, but has everything to do with the people, the men and women that stand behind those institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And that is about character, that is about the sort of habits of comportment or conduct toward our fellows, that is about a way of seeing ourselves in relation to our fellows. And I think it is this dimension, this sort of underlying dimension, that we haven't given enough attention to in the face of the ascendancy of Trump.
When you say the men and women who stand behind these institutions, are you talking about average Americans? Are you talking about the people that support those institutions in our government? Who?
I mean everyone. right? There is, right? So there is a need for political officials to sort of stand up to Trump to make sure that the administration of justice is not deformed, right? So we think about the Mueller investigation and these kinds of things, right? But then there are ordinary, everyday men and women who are not in and don't control the levers of power, but who have power to comport themselves one way rather another with respect to Muslim brothers and sisters, with respect to black men and women, so on and so forth, right? And so this sort of language of the habit of democracy cuts across mm-hmm. all of our institutions, both the highest forms of institutions, those governmental ones, and the lowest ones, sort of daily associations that we find ourselves moving through. And in all instances, the sort of longevity, the stability, the vitality of democratic life depends on those men and women that move through all of these institutions.
Reed, I know we were having some communication problems here. Were you able to hear much of what Melvin and I have been saying?
Yes, I was.
Okay. So I wonder if you think that we Americans tend to think of our democracy as inevitable. You know, it always is and it always shall be. And that relieves us to a certain degree of, you know, a deeper responsibility to it.
I mean, I think it's a combination of things. One is I think that there is that. Two is that, you know, I think we have gotten to a place now in our democracy where, you know, we have far too many voters who believe that, you know, my vote just doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I think we see that in, you know, the fact that, you know, in the primary elections and most, you know, statewide, you know, state elections or even, you know, in the midterms, you know, maybe you'll get out of the 30s as far as voter turnout is concerned. So people just don't believe that it matters. But I think there's another piece, too, which is, you know, and is that, you know, I think that there's also a belief among Americans that, you know, it's less about the electoral piece of this and more about sort of the freedom, which is so long as I can get out and complain about whatever it is I'm unhappy about, mm-hmm. that seems like democracy to me. Right. Like it's not necessarily about who I elect or whatever, because maybe that doesn't matter. Probably doesn't matter to my individual life because all I see is bad news. These people, you know, they can't agree on anything. But you know what? I can go on Twitter or Facebook or whatever and I can complain as much as I want. And nobody's going to throw me in jail or anything like that. So I think that it's, you know, there are so many things about this, as the professor was discussing, that are not just about going to the polling place. But I think that it starts in the fact that we have, you know, whether or not it's a lack of civic education in schools anymore, whether or not, you know, most folks who go to find news can't figure out through any fault of their own. But what are they supposed to believe? Who are they supposed to believe? There's so much screaming. There's so much carrying on. And even if only a million people at any given time are watching Fox News or MSNBC, that noise dribbles into sort of the larger ether of our communications.
Yeah, Melvin, this is so good. I'm so glad Reed brought up this idea that, well, as long as no one is going to stop me from saying what I want to say, I'm practicing democracy. All good. I mean, that speaks right to, I think, the argument that you're making in the piece, which is, it's a habit, and you have to practice it in a lot of different dimensions, right? Just saying, I can speak out, done deal, moving on, don't have to worry about this, isn't enough.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think that this sort of unwillingness or sort of inability, let's say inability, to see that one must be interested in more than mere voice, but trying to sort of convert voice, that is to say the criticisms, as it were, mm-hmm. to convert voice into real live practices is actually quite important. And I think it's absolutely correct that most Americans take comfort in the ability to critique as a condition of democracy. And at one level, that is, in fact, right. But there are other aspects to democratic life that have to be practiced in order for it to reach its full fruition, mm-hmm. among which is actually care and concern for one's fellows, right? And I think the fact that we've seen sort of a rise in hate groups, and I think we've seen a rise in mean-spiritedness, suggests that on the other side of this, there is a precipitous decline of care and concern, which is actually the hallmark of a society that claims to be engaged in self-governance.
This is a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, with Melvin Rogers, an associate professor of political science at Brown and the author of a piece that I spotted in the Boston Review called Democracy is a Habit, Practice It, and Reid Galen with us, a chief strategist of the Serve America movement, asking you this morning as you hear this discussion developing what you think the hallmarks of a strong democracy is. Is it economic fairness? Is it the ability to attain your version of the American dream? Is it just being able to vote when you want to and not when you don't? Is it the idea that you can speak out without censoring? How would you assess the state of our democracy? That's going to come in for a bit of conversation here this hour as well. 651-227-6000 on Twitter. At Carrie NPR to Karen in St. Paul. Hi, Karen. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to say I think our particular version of democracy in America has been really warped by sort of untethered capitalism, and that we are different from other democracies around the world that have a larger sense of what the common good is. And American capitalism is based, very heavily, and Donald Trump very much so, on this idea that the individual has a right to pursue profits and their own self-interest. And it really is to the detriment of the common good. And you look at some of the social democracies in Scandinavian parts of Europe, and they have a much better develop sense of the common good.
Yeah.
And I think that is what is fueling the meanness and the sort of viciousness that has taken over American society at this point.
Karen, thanks for the call. A lot to follow up on there. Read overall to what Karen said about this commitment to the ideal of the common good.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a couple of things. One, if you go back and you look at Alexis de Tocqueville, who came and visited the United States in the 1830s. And what he was fascinated by was the idea that Americans, even without the requirement to do so, sort of formed their own communities, or their own groups to get things done. And I think that is something that we have lost in some respect. And I think that what Melvin was talking about community is not just about the idea that we care about one another, but that we even care about what's going on immediately around us when we can look down at our light blue screens and be transported, a million miles away. And a lot of us, probably far too many of us, spend too much time doing that, right? We look down instead of up and out too often. I think to the point about, Northern Europe and Scandinavia, look, I think that what has happened there is probably, there are probably some lessons to be learned there. The one thing I always caution against is remembering that, I'm going to get this exact number wrong, but Sweden has, what, 5 million people, 10 million people?
Yeah.
L.A. County in California has 11 million people all by itself. And so, look, I don't know what the exact number is where you sort of become a largely ungovernable, group of people. But I can tell you that, when countries are the size of L.A. County, if that's the only population with which you had to contend, I'm not going to say it's easier, but it would certainly seem to be more manageable. I would also say that, look, capitalism is imperfect. Every economic and political system is imperfect. But I think that, the idea was rational self-interest, right, which I think that we have lost. We have lost rationality probably across the board, not only in our economics, but also our politics and our communications and how we discuss things with one another. So I think that there are lessons to be learned there. But I always want to caution folks against the sort of panacea of the Scandinavian model. Probably lots to be learned there. Not sure that even if we tried to do it here, it would work the way everybody wanted it to.
You know, Melvin, the other thing, and Reid speaks to this, the other thing I heard in Karen's comments were, we're losing the idea that we should be about a common good, that we hold that up as a high ethic of democracy. Do you think that's happening? That is something that John Dewey thought about, right, as a philosopher?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think this particular way of sort of putting it, that is to say that we sort of sort of lost the idea of pursuing, going after, conversing about something like a common good is actually quite important.
Mm-hmm.
It has never been the case in the United States that the good held in common has been stable. It has always been, from the abolitionist movement to our current moment, it has always been something over which we're struggling, something over which we're fighting, as we are sort of journeying to sort of improve the state of the union. But it has always been the case, right, that we've seen ourselves as engaged in thinking about just that, what ought the common good be, how ought we sort of organize our lives together. And I think it is not surprising that we have seen with, again, the ascendancy of Trump, the immediate attack by Trump during his election has actually been on community. It has been an attempt to persuade us and to persuade whole swaths of populations that cruelty is better than caring and being concerned about one's fellows, that it is this community, let's say Mexican Americans or African Americans, that are after your jobs. And so it's been to drive a wedge at the very heart of the society. Now, that's not possible unless there are already sentiments there, right? But someone has to work those sentiments back up to the top, manipulate them, and deploy them in a way that can divide the community. And as the community is divided, our interest and our focus on a good held in common slips from view.
What's interesting about this, and I think what gives some of us political whiplash, Melvin and Reed, is we went from President Obama's call to be our brother and sister's keeper 8 years to, I think what Melvin describes, Reed, I think describes accurately as a, if we want our common good to be better, we have to shut out, yes, people that are coming into the country, you know, a number of people that don't represent what that common good is. So Reed, how'd that happen? I mean, I think that's part of what historians are going to be working on for a long time. What's your read on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we've seen is, I say this, for, you know, probably more from a policymaking perspective, and let's just keep it at Congress, but I think certainly state legislatures are guilty of this too, which is that when a political party, you know, one of the two political parties that have dominated this country for 160 years, takes power either in a governor's mansion or a legislative house, regardless of the margin of that victory, mm-hmm. they immediately go and chase the most extreme parts of whatever that movement's
right.
desired goals are.
Right.
Right? So whether or not, what we see with President Trump and the current Congress vis-a-vis tax cuts, they were going to do whatever it took last fall or last winter to get that done, regardless of whether or not there was broad-based support for it, regardless of whether or not there was even broad-based support for it within the Republican caucus in the House and the Senate. They had decided that was what they were going to do. Now, you could make the obverse, which is, I'm not saying that President Obama's attempt or, you know, ultimate passage of the Affordable Care Act was not something done for the better good, but the method in which it was done, i.e., ultimately they decided, I'm going to get this done because if I don't get it done in 2009, 2010, it's never going to get done. He was probably right about that. Ultimately made Obamacare a singular partisan issue. It was not a health care plan or health care operation for the greater good.
Right.
It was a Democratic health care plan that had been placed on top of the people, you know, without their general consent.
I mean,
I'm not saying any of those things are true, but I think that's what you see is that the we do not have, and this also comes from, you know, closed primaries and more polarized things, which is everybody's afraid to work across the aisle.
I want to get to some callers here, but we can continue our discussion kind of on that part of it. That's interesting. To Sean in Rochester. Hi, Sean. Thanks so much
Hi.
For waiting.
Hi, thank you.
How are you thinking about this?
Well, I just think that the lack of historical knowledge or the lack of historical insight into so many of these problems is really key, because as you were talking about the Obama administration, they're not, there's people that don't even know that or remember or acknowledge that there was an economic collapse that was the, you know, that was the, that's how President Obama came into office and how he was able to turn that around. But Harry Truman famously said, the only thing new in the world is the history you don't know. And without a knowledge of history, we end up exactly where we are right now.
Melvin, what would you say to that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, but yeah, I'm going to go back to, I want to connect these things. I want to go back to something that Reed was talking about with respect to Obama and the Affordable Care Act. We can't dismiss or ignore the sort of lines of distortion coming from the right and understanding the Affordable Care Act. That's sort of par for the course when it comes to the competing parties. But I think the sort of vitriolic nature in which it was actually sort of deployed and engaged in emanates from a sort of deeper set of problems involving the fact that Obama was a black man in the White House. And so the whiplash that you referred to earlier, going Obama to Trump, has everything to do, I think, with race in this regard. The ascendancy of Trump is part of a general worry that America is browning and that there's a sense that the power of white Americans is on the decline. And that sense is precisely what sort of Trump has made amazing use of in his attempt to sort of divide and distort community. And so this is precisely why, per your caller, people don't remember that Obama actually saved the economy. It's actually a willful dismissal of the past and the work that he has done. And every advancement that we see today on the economy that is attributed to Trump comes about largely because, exclusively because, I would probably argue, because of what of the foundation that Obama put in place.
You guys are right to point to policy. I guess what I was asking was, especially in the 2008 election, Obama was showing America a version of itself that a lot of people wanted to believe about us, right? So was Donald Trump. Donald Trump was also showing voters a version of America. And I just find it, I'm going to be interested to read for decades about how we got from there to there. Policy aside, and I think, Melvin, to some degree, it speaks to what you were saying about then change began happening and a lot of people were pretty uncomfortable with it. Do you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is... I mean, this is one of the hardest problems for, you know, just as an intellectual, as someone who's concerned about these issues, to think about. Because it essentially, a crude way of putting it, is that there were two choices, two pictures of who we could become, two portraits of life in America. And Donald Trump's picture was opted for. Now, there's all kinds of complexities around the election, around how our voting system is set up, but nonetheless, he is now the president. So a choice was made. And the central question here, and it is a question that actually presses on the article that I wrote, and it presses on the kind of vision that Dewey is offering up, is whether or not the sort of vision of idea of democracy in which care and concern flowers, in which human dignity is affirmed, whether or not that is in fact the vision that we are really attracted to.
Right. Reed, what would you add?
Well, look, I mean, I think that you know, I think that in many ways, you know, especially we've had so many two-term presidents, you know, if we're going to take this to sort of the macro national level, you know, most successors to two-term presidents are some reaction to the previous 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So and I say this, you know, not to argue about Florida and the Supreme Court. But if you take what George Bush represented to people, you know, the country, you know, as close as it was, you know, was okay. I'm sort of done. I like the economic success, but I'm sort of done with the trouble that comes along with Bill Clinton and everything else. You know, Barack Obama was definitely a reaction to the 8 years of George Bush, which is we're down as a country. Our economy is in the tank. We're at war and we don't want to be at war. You know, we've got these morasses that just go on and we don't want that anymore. You know, whereas John McCain was saying, you know, I'll be in Iraq 100 years if it takes that. Right. People weren't looking for that. And so I think for better or worse, certainly, I think for worse in many ways, you know, Donald Trump was a reaction to 8 years of Barack Obama. I think we can't underestimate the fact that, you know, when you have, you know, two candidates, you know, in that the Democrats and the Republicans have put up for a nomination who have a combined, you know, negative rating of like 119%, you know, bad things are likely to happen. And I would say that, you know, if the Democrats, you know, both, you know, nationally and at the ballot box had, you know, did they really believe that Hillary Clinton, A, was the best candidate they had, and B, was a successor to carry Obama's legacy on? And the answer to both of those questions was probably no, because Donald Trump is historically unpopular even to this day. And so I think, you know, candidates ultimately matter, too, which is if you look at the message that President Obama was promoting as he ran for office in 2008 and again in 2012, he was not only somebody who had a message, but was also singularly able to convey that message to broad swaths of the American people, many of whom, as Melvin probably knows, had very little interest in participating in the electoral process. Right. We see Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton go up against each other in 2016, and turnout at the national level drops by millions and millions of voters. So candidates and how they project themselves also matter.
Good
Certainly
point.
Trump rode a wave of anger, and that is unfortunate because we are now, if he, you know, people say, and I'll stop after this, people say, oh, you know, Donald Trump was the result of all of this stuff. Maybe so. But he has certainly also taken it upon himself to exacerbate those things.
And that's really good context, really valuable. Joshua says on Twitter, the notion of democracy, once unpacked, turns out to be a can of worms. The foundation of democracy is information and individual will. Deadly weapons, easily manipulated. Democracy in itself is not a good. It is more like the atom bomb, self-contained good and evil. Ross says, the U.S. has always been a very reactive country. We tend not to address issues that everyone knows exist until they reach a complete crisis point, a bit like knowing you have a cavity, but not going to the dentist until your tooth is so painful it needs a root canal, to Ryan in Coon Rapids. Hey, Ryan, hi.
Hi. I was calling in because something that I don't think gets talked about enough is the structure of our democracy, the way we vote versus I think something like ranked choice voting would engage the voter more. Third parties, fourth parties wouldn't be activist parties. They'd have legitimate candidates and they'd be covered. And partisanship is a big reason, I think, why people are turned off from American politics.
Melvin, do you think it's the structure of the way we participate? This goes to some of what Reed was just saying.
I mean, I do think that the sort of how the, especially the presidential election is set up, doesn't incentivize people to rush out and vote. And it's only in instances, i.e. Barack Obama, where you are confronted with the unimaginable in Barack Obama, that one is pulled out of their otherwise normal complacency. But I think that there is something, and this goes back to Reed's point, I think there is something slightly off by the sort of previous analysis with respect to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. This too easily folds the 2016 election into the normal presidential cycles and logics that after two-term presidents, you have a counter response from the other side and the ascendancy of the new party. And the thing that it obscures about this is that for all that we might want to say about Hillary Clinton as a sort of a damage candidate, mm-hmm. I think that what's interesting about Trump is that the sort of sights of his problems actually bear on the very standing and dignity of persons in society. In other words, his issue, right, the problems that some of a good number of us had with Trump and continue to have with Trump, is not about this or that policy. It's about the background implication that classes of persons are not worthy of respect, whether they be Mexican Americans, whether they be African Americans, whether they be women. These issues actually go to the very core of what a democracy is. That is to say, that creates the very framework in which policies are developed, laws are passed, and the like. And under those circumstances, I don't know if we can easily fold this into the sort of normal logic of the Republican Party is just simply sort of responding to the two terms of Obama, and as history tells us, the other party normally wins. I think that too easily removes the way in which swaths of our society are actually complicit in the cruelty that Trump is really a sort of crystallization of.
I want to squeeze a quick call in here from Dan in Rochester. Dan, what are you observing about this?
Hi, thanks. I am calling because I want to know what the panelists think about the really big problems that democracy, not just American democracies, but all democracies across the world need to tackle. And I have in mind things like climate change and global warming and the inability to this point for most democracies to address these really existential problems that we're facing as a world and supernatural problems.
Yeah, I mean, Reed, this may be part of the reason that we judge our democracy as, you know, not fully fulfilled. We can't tackle some of these biggest crises that confront us.
No, look, I mean, and we have a long history, I think, as maybe one of the folks who tweeted in said that. We don't deal with things until we absolutely need to deal with them. I mean, go back to, you know, not the founding of the Republic, but the founding of the Republic as we know, which is the drafting of the Constitution. Look, most of those founders, half the founders anyway, were slave owners. And they knew that leaving slavery in place was a bad idea. And they did it anyway. They did it anyway because they were afraid of the economic consequences of having to figure out how to, you know, make rich white planters pay more for their labor. Right. That's a very and Melvin probably has a more articulate take on it than I do. My point is this, is that we were unwilling to deal with it in 1787. So in 1860, from 1861 to 1865, we had to deal with, the bloodiest conflict the United States has ever known. We constantly refuse to deal with these things, whether or not it is climate change. Look, Sam did a lot of work in Kansas earlier this year, and we were talking to some folks in the middle of the state, and they were talking about the fact that they were having a county meeting. There was going to be a federal grant to replace their water treatment center. And there was a gentleman there who said, "I don't care about clean water. I want to build a wall." Like, you can't argue with that. That is an inarguable part. You know, you can't deal with it. That person showed up, though, right? They showed up and they expressed their opinion, where 95% of the people in that central Kansas county probably said, "I would prefer to have clean water for me and my family." So I think that, you know, these are the kinds of things. Climate change is, I mean, who in their right mind does not believe that clean air, clean water, and a bright and vibrant future from an economic or an environmental perspective is not a good thing for the country and the world?
Reed, I have to call it there. Melvin, thank you so much. Reed, thank you.
No, thank you.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828. Or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.